is, Diane, on my mind, the U.S. braces for the spread of coronavirus.
The picture has changed dramatically in the United States since Friday night, as more state and local public health labs have been able to perform tests for the novel coronavirus.
The Seattle area has become the focus of emerging coronavirus cases in this country. Four more deaths announced there today, bringing the number of dead to at least six.
There is no doubt that there will be more cases where we find people who test positive. We said early on, it wasn't a question of if, but when.
Dan Diamond covers health policy and politics for Politico. He's been closely following this story. I spoke with him this morning. Dan Diamond, we're talking here on Tuesday morning. Give us the latest on what's happening around the country and around the world as far as the coronavirus.
Well, Diane, I've spent most of my life listening to you. I'm thrilled to be here. I just wish it was for a more pleasant topic.
Thank you.
There are now at least 100 cases of the novel coronavirus that we know of in the United States, and quite possibly hundreds or thousands more that just weren't diagnosed. Meanwhile, the virus has spread to more than 60 countries around the world with about 90,000 infections.
Now, how would those have happened? You've got China as the starting point. Are you suggesting that it's all come from China?
We live in a global economy. People travel every day all over the world, including between China and the Middle East. Folks in China may have gone to Iran, where there is now a major outbreak. There are major outbreaks in South Korea, even in Italy. All it takes with a virus like this is one person carrying it to a different country where it can rapidly spread. There's a saying in public health, if you find one case, there are probably two cases. If you find two cases, there are probably four cases. At this point, all we know is what testing has shown us, which are about 90,000 cases around the world. The actual number may be significantly higher.
Now, given the numbers of cases here in the United States, how many of those are related to the Princess Cruise Line and the people who were on that and then got off?
Great question. The initial high rate of coronavirus cases among Americans was concentrated with folks who had been on board the Diamond Princess cruise ship. For weeks, they were on that ship. The virus rapidly multiplied. I worked with one of my colleagues at Politico to write a story. We talked to people on the ship, as well as folks in the government who were furious that this situation had been allowed to fester. So until the past few days, most cases, maybe about two-thirds, three-quarters, were people who had come from that ship. But as more testing has come online, at this point, most of the cases are increasingly not from the Diamond Princess. They may be people who came from other countries, not China, into the United States, had been in Iran, had picked it up somehow in the community, and scientists are still trying to figure out what the origin point was for many of these cases.
Are you suggesting that some people with no history of travel whatsoever have developed the virus?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting. And that's what has public health officials so worried. This is what's called community spread. When a virus is spreading in a community, not from a point of a person traveling or a person who might be the wife, the father, the son of someone who came back from China, when there are people like in Washington State who haven't been out of the state but have contracted this virus, that is what has public health officials so alarmed.
Talk about that Washington State cluster, because at least as I understand it, you're talking about a group of elderly people in a nursing home. Now, could it be possible that any of the personnel in that nursing home could have traveled?
I think that's part of the theory, that it wasn't the patients in the nursing home who probably weren't traveling very much. It's the personnel, maybe a family member who came in. Again, all it takes is one person. And much like the cruise ship, a nursing home is almost a petri dish for viruses to spread. And these poor people who, as of Tuesday morning, I believe there are at least 18 confirmed cases of coronavirus with 6 related deaths in this nursing home in Washington state, that may just be the tip of the iceberg as more cases are diagnosed with several dozen other people under suspicion.
Let's talk for a moment about the testing process, because I think there was a little confusion. I think there were some mistakes made as far as that testing process was concerned. Explain what happened.
I think you're being generous by saying there was some confusion and a few mistakes. There were major mistakes. And in my time covering the health department at Politico and then at other outlets, this is on par with any mistake that I've seen in the health industry, in the health administration.
What do you mean?
The Obama administration took considerable grief for its failure to launch the Affordable Care Act websites in 2013. This was healthcare.gov, not having it ready to go. It crashed under demand, certainly a scandal, but one that was ultimately fixable in the weeks and months to come. I would actually argue it helped healthcare.gov because it got all this public attention. It became a major story, and people who might not have been aware that there was a website selling insurance, now they knew. There was another crisis a few years ago involving the health department, the separation of migrant families on the border in 2018 by the Trump administration. That was driven by the Homeland Security Department, White House advisor Stephen Miller, but the health department was involved too. They took custody of the kids. It was a major crisis, still affecting to this day.
What about the AIDS crisis?
The AIDS crisis dating back 35 years, major crisis. I was not covering that at the time. I was in kindergarten. But I think if you're looking at public health failures, this could end up being on par with any of the public health failures of the past few decades. A former health official told me a few weeks ago that if the United States missed an outbreak, that would be a historic public health mistake. It appears that's exactly what happened.
And yet, we heard President Trump just the other day call this coronavirus a Democratic hoax.
The president at a rally suggested that the coverage of coronavirus and specifically his administration's response has been a hoax intended to gin up anger at the administration and not accurately report all the steps that they are taking. I think some of this might be an eye of the beholder. There are Republicans who were insistent that the media is taking what is currently a relatively small outbreak and making all Americans panic. But I've talked to enough public health experts who say this is the early days of what could end up being a significant outbreak. And the more concern that leaders, health officials, even average Americans can bring to bear, the better position we will be in the weeks and months to come if we take the right steps now and the right urgency to get this under control.
This started out on the West Coast here in the U.S. with Seattle, with a few cases in California. Now it's moved to the East Coast with cases in New York, in Massachusetts, in New Hampshire. What do we know about those cases on the East Coast?
It depends on the case, but again, these can be cases that involve people who came back from being abroad. They might have come from countries that aren't China, which has had travel restrictions placed on it for weeks by the administration. But as the virus is now all over the world, it's possible someone came back from Italy. And I've talked to public health officials in local states who say, we don't have information on where people are coming from. We need more information from the airlines. We need to know where to screen for. Now, Diane, this may be moot in the days and weeks to come. If the virus spreads all around the world, it might not be sufficient to say we need to screen people from Italy. We need to screen people from Iran, South Korea. Because if the virus is in significant numbers in most countries, that raises bigger questions about how we fight this.
Dan, are we seeing different reactions from Democrats and Republicans on this issue? I know what we've heard from President Trump, who really played this down early on. But now we're hearing from Republicans who are very fearful of what's happening.
A public health crisis can transcend political party, and that's what we're staring down. A crisis that we know from China data can lead to significant mortality, especially among vulnerable groups, older people, people who might have immune-compromised health systems. The initial reaction from the Trump administration was one of playing this down. I reported with my colleagues that a major concern was his reelection. And a campaign that was built around the strength of the economy could be put at risk if the economy took a nosedive. We've already seen out of China production slowing down, people not going to work. That will have global ramifications, and companies in the United States have said they're feeling the pinch too. The Trump administration has ramped up urgency in the past few weeks, but as we've reported at Politico, there might not have been enough urgency, enough planning, enough worst-case scenario planning to prepare for this moment. Democrats on Capitol Hill have been furious with how much money the Trump administration is seeking in emergency funding. The Trump administration only wanted about $1 billion in new emergency funding, and then they were going to move around some additional money too. Democrats have said, we're prepared to go much higher, $8 billion, maybe more. I've talked to public health veterans who say the United States needs to set aside $15 billion for vaccines, for diagnostics, for therapeutics. Again, if this spreads widely, there will be a lot of people needing health services and really straining the health system of the United States.
In a recent article, you described the White House response as disjointed and chaotic. What do you mean?
Like so many parts of the Trump administration, the health department has been conflicted, fighting amongst itself, plagued with turmoil for years. This dates back well before the coronavirus outbreak. In 2017, a colleague and I reported that the health secretary at the time, Tom Price, was using charter jets to travel around the country. He was summarily fired, but that kicked off unbelievable internal battles over who would lead the health department, who would be in favor with President Trump. Those had died down, but there are still very deep cracks and fissures. Different gangs, essentially. People who were brought in by Mike Pence. People who were Donald Trump loyalists on the campaign. Folks who maybe worked for George W. Bush and are seen as a different wing of the Republican Party. I did not see this when I was covering the Obama administration. It may be possible that these similar fights happened and they just didn't play out as publicly. But for the coronavirus outbreak, what that's meant is different gangs at times taking pot shots at each other at a moment when they should all be working together to protect Americans. And they might be fighting over funding. They might be fighting over who's leading the effort. The health secretary, Alex Azar, was recently replaced by Vice President Mike Pence as the overall leader of the response. And some of that turmoil might be expected in a crisis moment as the pressure bears down. I think the amount of turmoil reflects the president himself and the kind of management style that he brings and how badly that can backfire at a crisis point.
How well equipped and knowledgeable is Vice President Pence to lead this effort?
That's a great question that we've been trying to answer. As governor in Indiana, Mike Pence led the state while an HIV outbreak spread. He's been criticized for not doing enough at the time with the knowledge that public health officials had to stop that outbreak in its tracks. It's possible he's learned from that. He will do a better job with this. And many of the decisions he needs to make, Diane, are not necessarily health decisions. They're management decisions. What countries do we need to make sure we're working with or we're imposing travel restrictions on? Do the people who are fighting this on the front lines have the resources they need? There might even be a silver lining to Mike Pence being in charge, which is he has more force than any of these fractious gangs in the health department. If Mike Pence wants something to happen, it will happen. And that might mean faster response on problems that have lingered for weeks, including the testing problem.
A quick break. More of my conversation with Dan Diamond when we come back.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Dan Diamond. He's a reporter with Politico, investigating health policy and politics, including the Trump administration's coronavirus response. Early on, after the president announced that the vice president would be in charge, Anthony Fauci of NIH, who has been on this program so many times, explaining so many serious diseases in this country, was said to have been muzzled. Since then, he has denied that, but at the same time, in an article in Politico that I just read, he says, you don't go to war with a president. So tell me about the situation that Dr. Fauci is in.
Dr. Fauci, who I think this isn't a violation of my journalistic principles to say that he's a national treasure.
He certainly is.
He's spoken with me. He's been on my Politico podcast. He is someone who has seen it all and fought it all for decades. Tony Fauci was reportedly not allowed to go on some Sunday shows that he had been booked on.
And that was right after the vice president had been named as leading the effort.
And also right after CDC officials had started to warn more seriously that the question of an outbreak was not if, it was when. The stock market was plunging at that moment. So connecting the dots, as some analysts did, Tony Fauci is not allowed to go on TV. Mike Pence is now in charge. All media appearances had to be cleared through Mike Pence. It did seem like Tony Fauci wasn't able to get his message out. You mentioned the story in Politico written by my colleague Sarah Overmall. Diane, Sarah was talking with Tony Fauci as that story was breaking. And I know that, without violating any confidences, I know that Fauci was insistent he's not being muzzled. But I also think the quote you pulled out is right. Tony Fauci is a career scientist. He knows the lines he can't cross. And if you watch him and Donald Trump in the same press conference, the president will often say something that is, frankly, wrong.
Wrong. And give me an example of what he has said that's wrong.
The president might say that a vaccine is imminent within the next few months. And Tony Fauci, the career scientist, has to come in and clean up that statement and say, well, yes, it might be ready for trials in a few months, but by the time it's actually rolled out to the American people, we could be talking a year later. So listening to Tony Fauci is essential to decoding what's actually going on.
So Dr. Fauci is appearing before members of Congress this morning. What do you expect to hear from him?
The members of Congress have a few big questions right now. One is, what the heck happened with America's testing for coronavirus? This is arguably the biggest problem.
What did happen?
We're trying to solve for that, too. It seems like it was a breakdown in multiple stages of the process. We knew, the U.S. public health leadership knew in mid-January that there were cases of coronavirus in the United States, people who'd come back from China. That was 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago. But testing that was rolled out to public health labs around the country didn't work. It came late. There are different possible explanations for this. The lab at CDC itself may have been contaminated. But what that meant was health leaders were flying blind for weeks as these cases multiplied. There are now efforts to provide alternate tests. But the question is, why did it take so long to do that? And I bet members of Congress are going to be pushing Tony Fauci. What is our testing capacity? When will we know what we don't know? And when will local officials be able to really get a handle on potential outbreaks in their communities?
So initially, it sounded to me as though there were way too few testing measures. Has that in and of itself been corrected?
Yes and no. So you're right, Diane. At the beginning, my colleague David Lim broke this story. There are 100 public health labs around the country. Only three of them had verified that the CDC test was even working. What that meant was local suspected cases would have to be then shipped to Atlanta at the CDC headquarters to be tested. That's a bottleneck. That creates several days of delays. And what it also means is you can't expand the testing parameters if you only have a limited number of tests. So people who might not have fit the criteria, who maybe didn't come from China but had all the other symptoms, couldn't be tested. That continues today. There are anecdotal reports, there are people who have told me in the government that many local patients who have questions, curiosity, still can't get tested. More tests are coming. They may be online by the end of this week, but the capacity still pales next to a country like South Korea, where residents can literally drive up and get tested without leaving their car. We don't have that. We will not have that. We might have it a month and a half from now, but it may be too late.
Can you describe the testing procedure that South Korea is using?
What South Korea has done and how it's been explained to me by people who either work in our government or have done disaster management before is set up essentially a tent, a building, sort of like a car wash where people are driving up. There are health staff who are protected and able to administer the test through rolling down the window of the car. The person can get the results while waiting and then go about his or her day. And that's essential to knowing who's at risk, who might be spreading the virus, who should be self-quarantining, all the things that the U.S. right now is flying blind on.
What kind of test is South Korea using?
The South Korean test is a swab where health workers who are protected are able to not just check temperature, but to quickly collect a sample and provide results.
That's interesting. And we do not have a comparable test.
We do have accurate tests. We just don't have them nationwide yet. Hospitals and laboratories were waiting on permission from the federal government to go ahead and devise their own tests in the meantime. That permission only came in the past 3 or 4 days.
So who's to blame for this?
If you book someone on your show who shares misinformation, is it your producer's fault? Is it the host's fault for amplifying it? I think at this point, it's unclear whether the failures were at the CDC, which has not just stumbled on rolling out the lab test, but made the decision to keep the quarantine in place on the Diamond Princess cruise ship. That was another mistake. The CDC director appears to have given President Trump and Vice President Pence the wrong information before a press conference this weekend, where President Trump talked about the wonderful woman who died, but it was actually a man in his 50s. So the CDC has a lot of hard questions to answer. At the same time, the CDC director has a boss. His name is Health Secretary Alex Azar. Folks have told me in a deeply reported story I did with my colleague Adam Cankren that Alex Azar didn't do enough to have his team ready to go weeks ago when the CDC tests weren't being rolled out, to have a second plan, to have hospitals and labs ready to go with their own tests, for instance. And now it's too late to make up for those mistakes.
What is Alex Azar's background? Does he have the kind of background that it takes to make such incredibly important decisions?
His defenders would argue that he does. That's the argument Alex Azar has made in the White House. He was a senior official in the George W. Bush administration.
Doing what?
At the Health Department, overseeing response to something like SARS, which was another coronavirus outbreak almost 20 years ago, one that was contained around the world successfully, I might add. And Alex Azar also has been in the pharmaceutical world. He was a senior leader at Eli Lilly before coming back to be the health secretary. His argument that he's made to senior officials, that he's made on national TV, is that there's a playbook to fighting a pandemic. And there's some truth to that. The question is, did Alex Azar follow his own playbook and get the U.S. in position to fight this?
Dan, what are the symptoms of this particular virus?
The symptoms are similar in many ways to something like the flu. A cough, a fever, headache. the biggest challenge is when the immune system reacts too strongly and can perhaps cause congestion and breathing problems. That's different than, say, the normal flu. And the immune response in some folks who may be already compromised might be exceedingly damaging. And what's tricky right now, Diane, is people who might have these symptoms, they resemble enough other colds that it's not clear without accurate testing whether they have coronavirus or something like the flu.
Dr. Fauci, again, in this article by your colleague, Sarah Overmull, has said that this is a very serious virus. The question is, how many people could, number one, contract the virus, and how many lives could potentially be lost?
It's a very serious virus for lots of reasons, one being simply how fast it has spread, the other being how serious it can be. The early data out of China suggested that about 2% of people who contracted it did die.
Which is higher than the ordinary flu.
By a multiple of 20. The flu death rate is 0.1%, so one person out of 1,000. The coronavirus death rate, 2%, two people out of 100. But that may have been influenced by lots of things that, as the virus spreads, won't be as significant. For instance, maybe it wasn't detected in enough people, and the actual denominator, as it's called, is much larger. There may have been thousands of cases that weren't detected. The Wuhan, China health system was also overwhelmed by a sea of patients and cases that they didn't know how to deal with initially. So it's possible that some of the people who passed away were suffering because the health system just was overtaxed. The people who are most at risk from the data out of China appear to be folks ages 30 and older. That's where 90% roughly of cases were concentrated, and especially people who are older. About 1 in 7 people age 80 and over in China who contracted the virus passed away. Meanwhile, those who are younger, only around 1% of cases were in teenagers and those under age 9.
You were reporting recently in Arkansas, certainly considered a red state. Tell me what you heard, what you saw.
I was in Arkansas just a few days ago for a long scheduled reporting trip that had nothing to do with coronavirus. But because I'm on the coronavirus beat, everything has to do with coronavirus now. And I worked on some stories while I was down there. And what was fascinating to me, Diane, was to be in a place so far from Washington, D.C. politically, a place that Donald Trump had won convincingly in the 2016 election, where Republicans are very much in control of local politics. But to hear on local television a Republican lobbyist say, this is a big problem. The administration has a lot of questions to answer about how prepared it was. And if the administration does not protect Americans, this could be an epic disaster for the president. The lobbyist, and I talked to him after, Robert Kuhn, he said this is like Hurricane Katrina was for George W. Bush. This could be like that for the president, maybe even worse.
What about the travel industry? Are we seeing any cutbacks on airlines?
I did have to think twice about getting on a plane this weekend in the middle of my coronavirus reporting. But I did it, and I think a lot of people are still doing it. Companies have cut back on their travel. Amazon, for instance, has warned against non-essential travel for its employees and told them not to go to certain countries where there are outbreaks. The airlines have shut down some flights too, have offered free change fees for people who might be concerned. It's going to be a big question how much global travel happens. I did see a striking visual of the plane flights in China before the coronavirus outbreak versus after, and how quickly in this visual, the flights over the country thinned out to just a fraction of what they were before. Now that's China, which has a very different command and control system than in the United States. But I do think we're entering a moment where we may be more fearful and more cautious of our fellow man. And that's sad, but perhaps that moment will be necessary to try and contain or mitigate an outbreak that could affect the most vulnerable among us.
Thus far, I gather only restrictions to China and Italy have taken place, but to no other countries.
The U.S. has been exploring further travel restrictions on South Korea, has raised advisories on going to Japan. As we're recording on Tuesday morning, I'm not aware of any more total shutdowns, but I know for days the White House has been discussing it. And there also have been related travel decisions or border decisions, like an effort to perhaps shut down border issues with Mexico. That seems to me to be political opportunism. There are not many cases of coronavirus that appear to be coming from Mexico, but there are people in the White House, and specifically someone like Stephen Miller, the immigration advisor, who very much want to see that situation on the border locked down. And I think that's something we have to watch for as reporters, people who are essentially profiting from this crisis, whether it's pharmaceutical makers profiting or political people who have their own version of what they want to see happen and using this outbreak as a way to get what they want.
NPR reported this morning that Amazon is trying to crack down on those vendors who are gouging consumers on face masks, on gloves, on all sorts of things.
I think anytime there is a public health crisis, a public health panic, there are people looking to make a quick buck. And good on Amazon for cracking down and trying to protect its customers, but there probably is still going to be rampant fear-mongering and also misleading information about potential cures or the right steps to take. Even the issue of masks is highly debated, whether the average American needs to be walking around with a mask. I have talked to health officials who say this might actually raise your risk because you'll be touching your face constantly to adjust the mask.
So, as you are reporting on this, what kinds of precautions are you taking?
Well, Diane, when I walked into the studio this morning, you and I did not shake hands.
Right.
Which was sad to me because I've admired you for so long, and there's nothing I'd like more than to do that. But I don't want to put you at risk, and I want to model the behaviors that I write about, which include washing hands thoroughly. I have my hand sanitizer on the table here. My wife and I have some supplies of food and essential medicine at home. I am saying this in hopes of being responsible and not trying to be a scaremonger, because the worst case scenario is we use that food and medicine in the days and weeks to come anyway. But it's always good to be prepared. I also think there's some responsibility if a listener is going to see someone who might be immunocompromised or who might be at higher risk. It's important to check on your family and make sure that your relatives are okay. But at the same time, just as if you would think twice before going into a cancer ward, if you've been traveling, if you've been in a situation where potentially you have this virus and might not know it, I might encourage those people to be careful before visiting someone who would be at higher risk for it.
Is there anything else you want to say before we close?
I've been asked repeatedly, what should the average person do? Because it's not productive to sit around and panic and be fearful. People should live their lives to the best extent. But I do think the average person can continue to bring pressure and raise scrutiny on the people who are supposed to be protecting us, the U.S. politicians, the public health officials, who, as part of their job, are supposed to be watching out for average Americans. So far, I think the government has dropped the ball on some pretty big things. Hopefully, those situations will be rectified. But if Americans care and are invested and are asking the right questions, pressure can bring action, and action can bring results and protection.
Dan, thank you so much.
Diane, thank you for having me.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.